the left will only further weaken our response, I think. It's not, and will further alienate us, right? We need to show a very, I think, a radical position at this moment. And that takes the space to say, no, I mean, we're not agreeing. We're not agreeing with the right in terms, I mean, but we are opposed to free trade. We are opposed to global capitalism. We shouldn't be afraid of that and to take that space again. And I think it's really necessary at the time, because without it, we can't provide any analysis that's relevant to people who are affected by this and who are moving to the right.
Yeah, I think Mustafa makes a number of really good points there. Left nationalism, or nationalism in general, left nationalism in particular, are political dead ends for the left, and very dangerous. It presupposes a common interest between, on the one hand, capital or business, and on the other, working class people, oppressed peoples. That is that the nation trumps class power and class struggle. And that's a really, really problematic position that both misrepresents how our world works, including the Canadian nation itself, because there is no nation that's independent of capitalist class, owners, workers, indigenous peoples, oppressed peoples, and so on. And it also just really can cause some significant political disorientation for people down the line, because the need for struggle at some point is it's not going to disappear. Whether the leaders sit and break bread with business owners on trade councils or sign manifestos with them or whatever it is, either way, we live in a capitalist society, and the need for struggle is going to always be present. And you tell people now that these people are your allies, and then at some point they're going to need to struggle against these very same people who you're telling are their allies. And so there's a real danger there.
That was Midnight Sun editor Todd Gordon, immigrant workers center organizer Mustafa Henaway, speaking with Dr. David Camfield on Victor's Children. Listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. Coming up next. Since launching in Toronto in 2006, Green Majority has become Canada's longest-running weekly environmental news hour, helping transform the environmental movement into a social justice-oriented push for a sustainable society. On this clip from a February 2025 episode, the panel review the roles of carbon, guilt, and degrowth as argued in Chapter 4 of Matt Huber's book Climate Change's Class War, Building Socialism on a Warming Planet. Here's a highlight from that conversation.
A warm, beautiful February welcome to the gorgeous Green Majority, Canada's longest running environmental radio show. That's how important everything we say is. And we are on CIUT 89.5 FM or on your local community radio station if your community radio station is intelligent enough to be syndicating this glorious program. And we are also on Harbinger Media Network or any podcast application. This is the much psychically imbibed and anticipated return of Stefan Hostetter after his baby break, and likely he will be scurrying off to take care of that child again. So the child doesn't raise itself.
If I am here, if you hear some crying in the background, that's Ember. That's her.
The child has the Hostetter forehead. This child is half forehead, just like Stefan and I and Megan. And we have Lauren Latour still in Brazil.
Still in Brazil, which honestly lends itself to the conversation we're about to have today. It's personal this week to a degree. Theoretically personal. We'll see. We'll decide that together.
This, of course, is the lovely scent of recycled pulp, because this is our continued book club on Matthew T. Huber's Climate Change as Class War. We are on Chapter 4, entitled Carbon Guilt, Privatized Ecologies, Degrowth, and the Politics of Less. This is a chapter where he goes into greater detail about what he considers to be the limitations of the middle class, the professional classes' focus on consumption and consuming less, and degrowth, degrowing the economy as a focus on climate politics.
He begins by talking about why he thinks that there's this focus around climate guilt and the way the professional class sort of internalizes their own guilt and then turns that into their belief system, which verges on austerity, which is how he characterizes parts of the degrowth movement. But my question is that in the past few years, we have seen a shift in messaging from some environmental orgs away from the idea of carbon guilt. You know, we've seen 350.org did this after hiring a former labor organizer and to a lead campaigns position. Here in Canada, the David Suzuki Foundation has framed its renewable energy work in terms of addressing energy poverty. And so it seems like some of Huber's critiques are being heard. And yet I do still definitely think that the idea of living lighter remains a key component of at least what most people think of as environmentalism, and I'm sure what many people who identify as environmentalists, if you ask them, you know, what they do or how they engage with environmentalism, I think that would be one of their answers for sure. And part of the reason for that is to defend oneself from claims of hypocrisy, which we'll talk about, I think, in the second section when we get to Lauren's question. But there's also an argument there that shifting purchasing is a way to weaken the capital class. You know, if you are buying less from Amazon, then theoretically Jeff Bezos is less powerful. And so you could imagine he's more easily toppled. But of course, the few environmentalists who are buying less on Amazon certainly have not prevented it from gaining incredible power. So my question is, how do you think we as a movement can focus our vision for the future on this sort of idea of more, but of a way where the majority of people have more, certainly, like majority of the world has more. You and I may not, but that generally speaking, the working class internationally has more, but also lives within the Earth's limits.
The answer that I would provide for this is maybe almost too simplistic an answer, but it's what feels, I think it feels true to me. It's at least what immediately comes up, which is that we have a billionaire class that has hoarded effectively, so much of the wealth and so much of the resources that the way towards a future where everyone has enough, that there is that sort of like abundance, not in the sense of having too much or an overabundance, but like satisfyingly enough and everybody is able to sort of live comfortably in a way that also lives within the sort of the physical limitations of a contained planet, of a contained biosphere, is that we have to redistribute that wealth and redistribute those resources away from the wealthy. That to me is just like the obvious answer, which is why I think we're seeing almost in my mind like a resurgence and maybe just a slight rebranding of the sort of the Occupy Wall Street idea of like we're the 99% and we are versus the 1%, if not the 0.001%. I think I've heard the word oligarchy more in the last 3 months than I have in the last 20. Oh, wait, how old am I now? 32 years of my life. So there is this sort of this rising class consciousness that I think is class consciousness that specifically focuses on that sort of that hyper, hyper wealthy billionaire class that has so effectively hoarded so much for so long now. And I mean, I don't necessarily know the math around it. I don't necessarily know the physics around it, but it seems to me that we could just redistribute their wealth, remain within planetary limits and provide enough for all. But I don't know, maybe I'm kidding myself.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like, we can do it in stages. Like, there's such a grotesque wealth disparity as is, and it's leading to a whole lot of anxiety and resentment and instability. And that's like a much more important contradiction to solve than like our own guilt on individual consumption. However, like, if I could choose to like never fly again and never drive again and never have hot water again, and like that would like solve the climate issue, I would still choose to do that. So it's sort of like there's always going to be the question of how much comfort do we want and what how that relates to the physical limits. And, but I also don't think we necessarily even know what the physical limits of the Earth really are. There was all this discussion about peak oil. And it's like, okay, no, we actually have a bunch of oil. We're sort of discovering the limits of the Earth as we go, even though there is that constant overshoot question of like of whether the Earth can reproduce all the resources that we're currently consuming.
And I mean, it's kind of hard because I think at least it's going to take some research on my part, at least, because my previous metric for like how many planets would we need in order to sustain our current level of consumption, those were all the old carbon footprint metrics or at least interfaces that I use. So like, I know at one point, back when we all kind of prescribed to that carbon footprint, individual carbon footprint sort of understanding of climate action, it was like, oh, we would need three planets to sustain your degree of consumption. But if we're calling into question that whole ideology or that whole sort of like lens through which we look at things, maybe the whole like three worlds way of understanding it isn't effective or is based on some sort of false data.
I was in a meeting last week where the one person openly was like, well, you know, we got to figure out what we are willing to give up. And that was sort of her first point. And that was sort of well in the room. And I do think that there is, and there's a reason why that resonates for people. But at the same time, the thing I'm stuck on a little bit is this tension. And I hope he gets to it later. But there's an obvious tension, especially as we sort of watch the dismantling of the American state right now by the tech oligarchs. The fact that the only institutions that are sort of big enough to combat these gigantic companies are states, and yet there's sort of this inherent violence of statehood in its existence that we, you know, are consistently criticizing in ways that borders aren't real. I have a really hard time imagining about how on earth we sort of strengthen the states enough to be able to sort of fight back and to regulate these like completely unchecked borderless money machines that seemingly can sort of move around and do whatever they want half the time without sort of strengthening the state in a way that might come back and sort of allow them, the state, to be used as sort of a quashing of sort of democratic or of people's opinions of things. Like, you know, and it really is a tough balancing act or way to sort of try to figure out how to move through these two things. Because like, yeah, like my question is how do you fly less? You invest heavily in high speed rail. And the only organization that is big enough to do that are states. You know, how do you change these massive systems? They would have to come from some version of organized set of people. And right now we have states. I guess you could argue that the answer is a more decentralized sort of human response that sort of still has some version of taxation so that you can bring all your money together to provide things like healthcare and infrastructure. That could happen. But like in the short term or even medium term, you are relying on states to do the regulation and to build the infrastructure that we would require to be able to see a world where we're not consuming as much, where our consumption is not as harmful on the earth.
Yeah, and I mean, we have so few examples of versions of collectives that sort of serve that function of a government in a way that's a little more egalitarian and a little more truly democratic. Like the one that always comes is like, obviously, like, people on the left love to cite the success of the Paris Commune, but like the Paris Commune collapsed in a matter of months. So how successful that really is as a model off of which to base what an alternative version of statehood that's maybe a little less imperialistic and potentially colonial and violent is hard to come by. And it doesn't mean we can't dream it up, but it does take some dreaming, I guess.
Well, I think to Huber's point about not being able to see the structure and acting where we think our power lies, like if people really do care deeply, the reason like these middle class people just focus on consumption is because they act where they believe their power is. And there's a sense in which we're afraid of each other, right? Like we don't want to build power with our neighbors because there's a lack of trust. So we want to act in ways that we think is a tangible power, instead of convincing one another that we can have a kind of collective power if we simply get together.
That's really astute, Dave. We lack trust in our neighbors, and I feel like that's something that's only getting worse as we continue to retreat, not just to our houses in the suburbs, but into like these digital spaces that only offer facsimiles of people to engage with.
There's an excerpt from a new episode of Green Majority. Find out more at greenmajority.ca, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. This episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by the Albert Advantage. Find out more about Calgary's number one podcast at albertadvantagepod.com. And finally, broadcasting since 2014, Vancouver-based Seriously Wrong is a bi-weekly utopian leftist comedy podcast featuring hosts Aaron and Sean and guests in conversations and interviews exploring themes like rent strikes, the justice system, why rich people ruin everything, airplane food, and more. Like on this February 2025 episode, exploring what it'll be like to wake up in a utopian society. Now here's the show.
How do you do? What's going on? It's the Seriously Wrong podcast, and we're those wrong boys over there, the wrong guys.
Yeah, those wrong ones. Boys, the wrong boys, Sean, Aaron, I'm Aaron. That's Sean. Hello. Boys who are wrong. That's us.
Yeah. You know, one of these days, we're going to be wrong men, but not today.
I don't know. I think that would have happened by now. You know, we can't just keep waiting around assuming one day, hoping we'll be wrong men, but
it actually reminds me, the over there thing reminds me, my toddler, she's almost two. And if I'm showing her stuff in a book and I'm like, hey, what's this? And she's like, oh, zebra. And I'm like, yeah, what's this? Camel. Yeah. If I point to something she doesn't know, she'll say that one. What's this? She's like, that one.
It's true. That is that one.
Yeah. No, accurate. It's a good workaround.
Always right, that kid.
So today, this is a very special episode. You know, we're going to be talking through one day in utopia. We're going to talk through one day in a perfected library socialist, ecological, luxurian utopia that's directly democratic, a commune of communes where everyone's paid according to need, where we live within the limits of the planet, but we have a higher standard of living than has ever been achieved before in history. Another way of saying that, utopia.
Yeah, people seem to like when we talk about future societies, what they look like, or do sketches within them. There's a lot that can be gained by just kind of putting yourself in the situation, trying to think through, like, what would a day look like in a utopian society? What would it actually be like to be in there? You know, not just like theoretically, oh, everything's democratic, or do you have access to everything you need, or whatever. What's the visceral sense of what it's like. So that's what I'm trying to capture. Obviously, you're gonna have to use a bit of imagination. We can't physically teleport you there, but we're gonna paint a picture with words.
We're working on that. And if we get a few more patrons on Seriously Wrong,
yeah, I think it's a Patreon goal for 5,000 per month, then we will build the teleportation to a utopia machine. But yeah,
if we get 5,000 subscribers per month who are giving that sweet six to get access to the whole bonus, all the archive, all the bonus episodes, then yes, we commit to fully creating some sort of time machine that goes to a particular future that is good out of many possible futures. We're going to try our darndest to do that.
Well, yeah, we're a long way off from 5,000. So for now, we're just going to do this in an auditory world building kind of way.
Oh, another morning in Utopia. Okay, I'll just put my slippers on and walk down the block towards the coffee hub.
Hey, neighborino.
Hey, neighbor.
Good morning. How's your day?
Well, it's looking pretty good so far. The sun's shining, birds singing. How are you doing?
You know it. Just another beautiful day in the taupe, utopia.
Taupe. Oh, I like that. Yeah, catch you later.
Fido, leave that nice man alone. Sorry, he gets barking sometimes early in the morning.
Oh, it's okay. I love dogs.
Harmless. Oh, how is your mom, by the way? I remember there was some medical
issues. Oh, yeah,
issues.
No, she's doing much better. Yeah, no, they dealt with it super fast. She got seen right away and got everything she needed. So.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, that's normal for us. Yeah.
Yeah, it's normal, but I'm still glad you checked in because that shows that you care. And I would do the same for you, neighbor.
Yeah, and sometimes even with immediate attention, things don't always go perfectly. But I'm so glad to hear that. That's amazing. Your mom's a real gem. And so are you.
Oh, thanks. Well, yeah, I owe a lot to her. She is a gem. All right, well, I'm going to the coffee hub, so you have fun. I'll see you, Fido. All right, now the coffee hub. Yeah, I think I'll just go with a regular drip coffee today.
Medium roast, dark roast, any roast, all kinds of roasts, mixed roast.
Yeah, medium. Here, I brought my own cup.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, and there's cream, sugar, everything on the side there. You can serve yourself, you know, make it just how you like it. And nice shirt, by the way. That is snappy. That color looks great on you. Matches your complexion.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I took it out from the clothing library, but I think I'm probably going to hold on to it for a while. It does look great, hey?
Yeah, it's beautiful. I think, actually, see that seam there? I actually sewed this shirt up when I was working at the clothing library.
No way.
Yeah.
You did a killer job.
I knew I recognized it. That's great.
Huh. Well, jack of all trades over here. Perfect coffee, great stitching. I mean, you're making me look like a lazy piece of crap. Just kidding.
Some days you want to stitch. Some days you want to serve coffee. But hey, you do a lot, too. I know you do. Enjoy your day.
Well, we're all called to serve our community. So I'll just write a quick little compliment for you down on this piece of paper and fold that and put that in the compliment jar.
Oh, you didn't need to.
No, but I mean it. Don't read it till the end of shift, though.
Don't want to read them all at once. It'll go to my head. Reading all these compliments.
No, I know you. You're a humble guy. You can handle it. And I'll just sit down with the newspaper here. Oh, that's a nice headline. World Peace Continues. I mean, that's great news. Oh, that is great. Garfield has gone so funny since they went open source. Really beautiful art, too. Local child genius cures rare cancer. Well, that's good news. Apparently only 6 people in history have ever had that type of cancer, and now it's cured. Well, I guess we are running out of types of cancer to cure, so that's great. A child genius, too. I'm glad he got the support he needed to contribute. And no more plastic at all in the ocean, say scientists. That's incredible. I mean, it's been a while since we put any plastic in, but I know it takes a long time to get it out, so... Yeah, things are going all right. Oh, my phone. It's my wife. Hello? What do you mean? No. No, you're not serious, are you? No. No, that can't... What? This is the worst thing that's ever happened to me in my life. Oh, my God. Ugh. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, thanks for telling me, but... Fuck, okay. Okay, I'll see you soon. Bye.
I wasn't meaning to eavesdrop there, neighbor, but I couldn't help but overhear you. It sounded like something pretty bad on that call. Do you need help with anything? Or I was just running out to a massage appointment, but I can postpone it. Always here to help a neighbor out.
No, it's okay, but thank you so much for your concern. I don't mind at all that you heard some details of my call and came to my aid. No, I actually really appreciate that. It's just... My wife, she spilled some milk on the counter... So we're going to have to go wipe that up. I have to go home and wipe that up. So.
Oh, no, that's horrible. Yeah, with spill-proof cups being ubiquitous, that's really rare nowadays. I can see why that would be difficult for you.
Yeah, I know. It's not our fault. It's just this stuff happens, but still. I think we should be able to, hopefully none gets in the corners or the little seams or whatever where you might have that kind of milk smell later on. But I'll just do my best. I'll go, take my coffee and... We'll deal with it together, you know. Well, and if anything, it will strengthen our relationship to overcome adversity together. So, I mean, there's a silver lining. I don't want to overreact. It's just that I've never had something that bad happen to me before.
Right. Yeah. No. Well, yeah, if you ever need someone to talk to, you know, not that I've done professional counselor training, but I also sometimes volunteer at the if you ever need to talk center. I like to volunteer there for people come and just need to chat about something. So my ears are always open if you need one. That's what I'm saying.
Well, thank you. That's, I mean, just having that offered even is just like a huge boost for me. That's great. I really, really appreciate that. Thank you. It's actually making me feel better just to know that there are people around who are ready to help in different ways. But I feel like I'm okay right now and I don't need that help. But just knowing that that help is there is just huge. So thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you too, neighbor. Thank you.
I love the belt buckle, by the way. What is that? A skull with flames? Really, really cool stuff.
Yeah, that's what I said. I was like, oh, that's so badass. I have to take that out. I waited on hold for weeks to get it.
Oh, yeah. I bet you there's a lineup for that bad boy.
Yeah, no, definitely.
All right. Well, thanks so much. I'll see you around.
See ya.
So how does the day start?
I think most days start for most people with waking up. It's the first thing that you do.
That's right. Yeah. Does it count as a...
Or I guess you'd start sleeping.
You are asleep at the beginning. Yeah. If you're talking about the calendar transition.
Yeah. Like, when does a day start? When you're done sleeping? When you start sleeping?
The social experience of a day always starts with waking up.
Yeah.
But it might not line up to the calendar day.
The conscious experience of a day.
Yeah. I think we're talking about like one conscious experience of a day in utopia, not one calendar day in a utopia, right? Where this is the,
but
the human perspective.
Like, I feel like your sleep affects the whole day. So in a way, I feel like the day kind of starts the moment you fall asleep, because that's...
It's an investment.
I think of, you know, if I'm sorting my sleeps into either the day before or the day after, I would sort the sleep into the day after, because it affects it more. Like, your whole day is affected by that. So,
absolutely. So starting with sleep, I mean, what's sleep like in utopia? Well, it's deep. It's restful. I think that technologies that kind of like monitor your breathing and stuff like that, if done in a way that's privacy conscious and is oriented around like benefiting you to understand your sleep better and sleep better, that type of thing, there's room for that in a utopia.
Yeah, I think one crucial thing is that you wouldn't be limited in how your sleep setup is set up. It'd make it you have like a less than ideal sleeping situation, like being unable to have your own room or being unable to have a bed that's comfortable for you because you can't afford a new mattress, or, you know, sleeping in a room that's too hot, too cold, too light, too loud.
Sleeping on someone's couch because you're like in between apartments and the cost of living is too high.
Sleeping in your car, yeah, because
Sleeping rough on the streets, like that is absolutely something that just doesn't exist in our utopian society. There's always, every night there is ample empty beds that can be filled at a moment's note. If you're tired and you have no place to sleep, there is somewhere in every community where there's rows and rows of comfortable, available, clean beds where you have privacy.
There's a highlight from a recent episode of Seriously Wrong. Find new episodes of the internationally acclaimed utopian leftist comedy show at seriouslywrong.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about Calgary's number one podcast at albertaadvantagepod.com, and by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of 25 progressive publishers and get all your progressive news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger and now Blue Sky for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 80 socially and politically progressive podcasts. See you back here for a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
CJSF 90.1 FM SFU Burnaby.
So Some politicians love to tell us that we have to choose between policies that support people or policies that grow the economy. But we don't have to choose. A strong economy isn't only about stock markets and GDP. It's about all of us being able to afford our rent, our groceries, our medication. When we all thrive, the economy thrives too. Together, we can demand better. Take action at demandbettertoday.ca.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns, to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcasts.